Hello, kids. Bat Segundo here. And while this week's guest has no problem dwelling upon a year of fog, our young roving correspondent failed to ask her about a more pressing condition. Namely, a lifetime of fog. That's something I've been contending with for quite some time. But there haven't been chapters or days or any kinds of markers whatsoever. So what's left but a drink and to feel sad about the kids you accidentally left at the orphanage? Oh, but never mind that. Michelle Richman has proven decidedly non-responsive in light of my emails to her. Yes, that's right. Bat Segundo has joined the 21st century. You can email me at batsegundo.gmail.com. Or is it at gmail.com? I don't know. Maybe you're better than Michelle Richman. Maybe you're better than our young loving correspondent. Maybe you're even better than me.
Okay, so I am here with Michelle Richman, author of The Year of Fog, as well as Dream in the Blue Room. Michelle, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you, Ed?
I'm doing fantastic. Mm-hmm. I apologize for my hoarse voice.
That's all right. You have a good reason.
Yes, exactly. This is the last interview in San Francisco. Well, first off, let's talk about this book. I wanted to actually ask you, I noticed in the beginning that there was a good deal of research that you did. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if this was kind of a plotting you did in advance or if you wrote as you went. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can kind of describe how the research kind of played into the role of writing. I was curious about this.
Well, I did not plot the book out in advance. I knew the starting point, which was a girl vanishes on Ocean Beach in San Francisco. But I did not know the ending point. I knew there was going to be a search involved, but that's pretty much all I knew. And the research came in when I discovered that it was really kind of going to be a book about memory. And so I started researching how we imprint memory, how we store it, how we retrieve it, how we reconstruct it. So a lot of the research was reading books on memory and even talking to a neurologist about how the amygdala works and the hippocampus and all this stuff. And then other research was on photography because Abby, the narrator, is a photographer. And a lot of that came from talking to my sister, who's a photographer.
Ah, so I didn't realize
that was convenient.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, Abby has a sister in this too.
Yeah.
So yeah. I'm curious about, you know, the relationship between you, Michelle Richman, and Abby, because she's also an Alabama transplant who comes to San Francisco, and I kept saying to myself, this sounds a little bit like Michelle.
Well, you know, I have noticed as I get older, it seems like the main characters, this is probably unfortunate, the main characters of my stories and books tend to age with me,
yeah.
You know, so I never seem to have anyone who's wildly different in age than I am, but at the time I started the book, I was probably 33 or something, and as she is. And I grew up in Alabama, as she did, and am a transplant to San Francisco. But I think that's as far as it goes, really. It's
maybe we should use the word emigrant. Transplant sounds so, like, you know, like you're getting
so
an
medical
operation or
something. She's an immigrant to San Francisco. Yeah. I mean, I guess part of it, for me, part of a novel, obviously, is just having a background for your main character. You don't necessarily have to go into a lot of the background, but you need to, as the writer, I need to understand who she is. And I've written a lot about Alabama. I haven't lived there in, I don't know, maybe 18 years, but I can't seem to entirely get it out of my system. So this is my first book that was really separate from my upbringing, but yet there's a tiny bit of that Gulf Coast stuff sprinkled in there, since that's where she's from.
I wanted to actually ask you about the landmarks throughout this book. I was reading this and it was like, wow, she's name-checking nearly every conceivable landmark. But the thing that's interesting about the places you choose are like, you know, Pasquale's on Sloat, Mel's Drive-In, things like that. They're sort of places that someone who hasn't been here that long would notice, but you don't really have that until near the end of the book. Mm. You have sort of, I guess, more obscure places. I mean, like Blue Danube Cafe, for example, which we're sitting at right now. That doesn't make its presence known. And I was wondering if you could talk about what you did in terms of, did you make a decision as to, you know, to feature more prominent landmarks as Abby is searching around trying to find this girl?
Well, that's a good question. I think, well, I started with Ocean Beach, which is, I live 10 blocks from the beach, and a lot of what's around there is very prominent. So you have the Cliff House, which has been there, you know, since the turn of the century, or before the turn of the century, and that's a spot that tourists know, but it also happens to be a place that, you know, just my life living so close to that is very much a part of what I see every day, and Seal Rocks, and so, and then also Golden Gate Park is featured prominently, and I live a couple of blocks from there, and so since the child disappears on Ocean Beach, a lot of the search takes her through Golden Gate Park, which is a very prominent landmark, but to me it was a natural progression that, you know, that would have to be part of the search, as would those things out on the coast. But I think places that people don't know about the city, they may know those landmarks, but they probably don't know really what the Richmond district is like. Like these bizarre little, like the typewriter repair store and the vacuum cleaner repair store. I mean, who has places like this? I mean, you know, vacuum cleaner repair. And
you moved to the Richmond district clearly for reasons pertaining to your surname.
Oh, obviously. So I think what the places that appear in the book are just part of my experience of San Francisco. A lot of spots in the Mission that are in the book are just spots that, you know, are places where I eat or buy books or drink coffee or that sort of thing. So there was never a conscious decision to feature a particular type of San Francisco landmark. But, you know, I think one thing that happens in the book is Abby visits these landmarks that she hasn't visited before, like Coit Tower, just because she's trying to search every square inch of San Francisco. And that happens to be one of the places where she thinks, oh, there's all this thick vegetation and there are these stairs, you know, maybe a child could be hidden here. And she kind of has that thought about every place that she goes to in the city.
But it's interesting that she goes to some place like Coit Tower, where she's not necessarily likely to find the girl, perhaps, but simultaneously this becomes 100 pages into the book. What we have here is someone who becomes extremely sort of, I mean, obviously obsessive, but it becomes about more than this. And then she starts to really recontextualize her own kind of construct of, you know, basically living and memory and things like that. I guess I wanted to ask you about the prominent landmarks, because it also seems there's also a very strange figure I wanted to ask you about, and that is the emasculate. Oh, yes. David, who lives in this restored Victorian.
Oh, yeah. little creepy.
Well, yeah, he is. I mean, not only have you made this guy totally emasculated by giving him this sort of thin chest and the hairless kind of thing, but you describe his restored Victorian as inside dark wood floors and utter silence. So this led me to believe that, like, you know, what she does discover are these really just terrible places of loneliness, as opposed to life. Maybe you can talk about why emphasize these more lonelier parts of the city. It's like this is almost the real story of the book here.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think part of it is just that because she's in such a place of darkness and loneliness, having lost this child, and also having completely destroyed the relationship with the man that she was going to marry, I think the way she perceives the world is very much altered by that reality. And I also think that if someone that you deeply care about, particularly someone who is in your care, if something terrible happens to them, and if you are have no control over their fate, or, you know, you feel utterly helpless, I think that so colors the way that you see the world, that she's more likely to see the despairing places, and she's more likely to see the malaise than she is to see sort of the bright, happy things around her. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I get that. But I mean, it's also like even her name, Abby, and there's a penchant here for four-letter names, almost palindromic, Emma and Abby. But the thing about Abby that's interesting, it's like you go A to Y, I guess. So the sense was that I got in reading this book, was that it was this sort of, I guess, quest for, you know, trying to figure out who she is, and basically sort of destroying, I mean, inevitably, without giving anything away, she goes to Costa Rica. And I guess maybe we could talk about how the character names sort of tie into this, I guess, personal journey of these four, or why four-letter names here, why palindromic?
You know, it's interesting that you point that out. It certainly wasn't intentional. Let's think. Okay, so Jake, that's four letters. Yeah. You know, for me, names are always really difficult, because I hate it when I read a book and the names are very obvious. I mean, not always. I mean, sometimes, you know, that can be wonderful. But, you know, I in particular, I don't like cutesy names or, you know, names that seem like they're lifted from the soap opera. So I was looking for very basic names. So we have Jake, Emma, Abby. Who else is in there? Or Abigail. But yeah, she goes by Abby. Her sister's name is what? I'm drawing a blank. See, I should know this.
Yeah, I should know this too.
No, I really should know it. For some reason, I'm drawing a blank on
Annabelle.
His name. Annabelle, yeah. David. Yeah, another AB name. For me, it was just Emma, I think, was the name that I came up with for the child because it's just sort of a common name. I mean, that's a very common name. So I wanted something that was sort of common, that it didn't draw too much attention to itself, so that the characteristics of the child were more important than the name. As for the other names, you know, that's a good question. I'm going to have to ask myself that on my next book, exactly what they all mean.
Well, I mean,
really, it's for me, a lot of it is about sound, too, you know, just how it sounds in a sentence. And I don't want a name that's going to take over every sentence that it's in, you know, but I really didn't think about them being four-letter names at all.
I'm just curious. Yeah. Well, okay, well, I mean, you know.
But they are.
Yeah, they are. Well, I actually wanted to ask you, I mean, near the end of the book, first of all, there's a lot of chapters in this book. There's like 80 chapters.
Yeah. And then, but they're all really short.
Well, did you write these in like one sitting each chapter, or what was the situation there?
A lot of them I did. Certainly not all of them. Yeah. But I think in the best moments when it was working, I mean, you know, as a writer, when it's really working for you, you can sort of get a piece of a story out there all in one sitting. So a lot of the chapters I did write in one sitting. And I like short chapters. I like the way they make a book move. I thought that they were fitting for this book because it's a book, in many ways it's a book about impressions, and she's searching sort of these impressionistic memories of that day to try to figure out what happened. I like the speed of short chapters, and I think that the narrative is a little bit fragmentary in some ways, and I think that lends itself to very short chapters.
The epitaphs that kind of kick in near the end, again, going to this sort of theory I'm trying to sort of coax out of you about finding meaning and finding identity and this kind of thing. Did the epitaphs sort of, when did you kind of know that this was, because you didn't plan this book.
Right.
So when did you know that this was kind of about, you know, Abby's personal sort of quest here in terms of?
Well, I think, I knew that it was, I knew fairly early on that it was about her quest. I mean, an actual search, but probably more importantly, like you say, about who she is and, you know, and who she's going to become through this journey. But as for the epitaphs, one of my favorites is the Lars Gustafsson quote from The Death of a Beekeeper. And what he says is, "We begin again, we never give up." And he repeats this throughout that book and others of his books. Comes to a point in the book where Abby has sort of gone on a new journey or a new branch of this journey. And she's feeling some degree of hopefulness, and she's thinking, well, you know, maybe she can sort of turn things around. She has no certainty, but she wants to think that this is a possibility. And so that's where, I think probably before I even wrote the chapter, I had that Lars Gustafsson line in my head, "We begin again, we never give up." And there's also, you know, one of my favorite books is The Moviegoer, and I think probably Bat Segundo listeners are probably familiar, a lot of them are going to be familiar, very familiar with that book, but one of my favorite lines from that book is, "To become aware of the possibility of a search is to be on to something. Not to be on to something is to be in despair." And that was almost going to be the opening lines for the book, you know, after the title page. But then I decided there's something else I really wanted to use, so I didn't use that. But I used that later in the book because, she's really driven through this book by the search for the child, but also the search for something deeper. She comes to realize late in the book that if this is taken from her, if the possibility of a search is taken from her, she really doesn't have anything. It's not only the girl she's looking for, she needs this forward motion of the search.
Well, the search is also this excuse to essentially go ahead and, you know, okay, well, I'm roughly around 30, I'm just going to go ahead and completely let loose here. it's almost as if, this is why the image of the guy in this really restored Victorian, but terribly, you know, loneliness and all this. It's like, okay, you know, is I'm like, if you're doing so PR for San Francisco here, it's actually you're dealing with a lot of loneliness and solitude as opposed to the kind of great life that we had talked about earlier. I mean, I guess, to what extent did you design the search as this excuse to kind of go nuts here, Abby go nuts rather?
Well, you know, I don't think I designed it for that purpose. I think that may be what developed as I was writing.
Yeah,
it was a consequence of it. I think her going nuts,
By going nuts, you mean
she loses hold of everything.
She
right?
takes
her work.
She loses track of her relationship, her work. Mm-hmm. By go nuts, I'm implying that she goes bananas. No, she decides to use this as an excuse to essentially, like, you know, go in this sort of anarchic, unstructured existence. Yet at the same time, this is kind of counter, contrapuntal. This idea of a counterpoint of her also searching for this girl, which is the one sort of thing. I mean, it's almost as if she takes her existing sort of identity and then uses this. Okay, well, this is no longer a factor. She can only do one at a time, which I found quite interesting. I'm wondering.
Well, I think what happens is that, you know, Abby probably wouldn't think of it as being an excuse for doing those things, although that it probably does become that for her. She's had sort of a controlled existence. Mm-hmm. Her life has been sort of, you know, a steady line. She's always known sort of what she was going for. This happens, well, everything is corrupted, and it does, basically the rest of the stuff doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, what matters is finding the child. And yes, this deeper search that is part of that. But I mean, but finding the child really is paramount to her, even if that's an impossibility. Mm-hmm. And even if it's totally illogical and irrational. Yeah, in many ways, she throws logic aside, which is the opposite of what her fiancé does. Her fiancé is very clear-headed about it. He thinks, okay, we've put out a million flyers. You know, there are no clues. She's not here. That's it. Obviously, she's dead. Abby won't believe this. She's irrational, but her rationality, I think, is part of an absolute inability to accept that she has made such a monumental mess of things.
Maybe I should ask you, you know, were there any specific kidnapping cases or disappearance cases that you based,
There weren't any, but, you know, I mean, we always go through those periods in our news cycles when there will be a slew of disappearances that get a lot of attention all at one time. And I think it's a high possibility that when I was first conceiving the idea for this book, it might have been in that sort of period. There was an actual moment on the beach where I saw a kid in the fog who was alone, or appeared to be alone, although probably she wasn't because she was very young. Looked away, looked back, and she wasn't there. And that was sort of the physical germ of the story, seeing this. And I think that probably played in with sort of the constant knowledge we have in our culture of disappearances. Mm-hmm. So there was no specific case, but certainly it's something that I have, long before I had a child, I think I was completely unnerved by the idea of a child going missing and the people around that child knowing nothing about I think it's one of the most absolutely horrifying things that can happen. And now that I have a child, I can't imagine how anyone goes through that and doesn't completely unravel. Because on the one hand, there would be this desire to commit suicide because how could you live? But on the other hand, you couldn't commit suicide because you would have to be, you know, you would have to continue the search. So I don't know. To me, it's very dramatic in that just the actual situation when you see it play out in real life. And it happens a lot. I mean, some of the cases make the news. Most of them don't. And it's horrifying.
Yeah, that's very true. I wanted to actually ask you also about the imagery in this book. There seems to be a concern on your part. Well, I mean, what with the sand dollars at the very beginning, you actually have a moment at Sutro Baths, which is the ultimate in terms of, like, you know, corruption of natural elements by humankind. And then there's, of course, the barge, I believe, out in the waters, and there's all this refuse that you describe. And it's almost as if, again, I, I, it, maybe this is just me, but I just was like really looking at some of this imagery and saying, oh, this is a different kind of San Francisco in the sense of concentrating upon how the humans who exist here. I mean, and it goes into the title of the book, The Year of Fog, which we could also talk about too. What in terms of location, I mean, you know, were there specific things like this refuse or this interference by humans of, you know, basically taking this rather delicate, you know, sand bed that we're all sitting on here. Was this something that you were trying to kind of play up in terms of the imagery, or did the imagery kind of announce itself, or was this all subconscious? Or?
I think a lot of the imagery just came about in the process of writing about the thing I was writing about. And, I mean, these are... You know, there is a certain San Francisco that, you know, that's represented in the little glitter globes.
Yeah.
And it's a certain kind of San Francisco with this little, you know, pretty looking Chinatown or, you know, this pristine Golden Gate Bridge. But anyone who lives here, anyone who lives anywhere for any period of time recognizes that, you know, the patina wears off very quickly. And I love this city, but what I love about the beauty of this city is, to me, it's a very dangerous city, dangerous beauty. It's a tenuous beauty. Yes, we are built on sand. I mean, where I live, the whole, you know, for many blocks out, the neighborhood where I am was until very recently just sand dunes. So yeah, all these houses are on sand. I mean, you know, it's not the best place. When I was a kid, we used to sing this song about building your house on sinking sand. It was some kind of religious, creepy song, but it's true. Yeah, I mean, this whole, you know, civilization out in the westernmost part of San Francisco that is built on this.
I guess I'm just trying to. Oh, sorry. I'm wondering if there was some sort of like apocalyptic mindset. This apocalyptic idea. But I used to live in the Sunset years ago. Same sort of thing. We're built on sand, and the beach is the closest part of San Francisco to the San Andreas Fault. So I'm wondering if this sense of danger was. I mean.
No. Yeah, I think that sense of danger is very much a part of the book, and it's very much a part of my experience of the city. Yeah. And, you know, it is. Ocean Beach is not, I mean, it's not a beautiful, it's beautiful to me because it's, you know, these waves are insane and the water is freezing and you don't go there in your bathing suit, you know, and you don't swim in the water. You just don't do it.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful because of all that. And there's, you know, ashes all over the beach and there's graffiti all over the seawall. I mean, it's kind of ugly in that way. Yeah. It's very much an herb. I mean,
there's metal signs saying, like, you know, be wary, you could die. The wind will throw you off the cliff.
Yeah. It's dangerous and it's kind of an urban wasteland, but it sort of has this end of the continent feel to it, but it's beautiful despite that and because of it.
Perfect.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Hey, you know, we can riff as much as we can. Well, I mean, the original title of this book also was Ocean Beach, and when did it switch to Year of Fog, and why? Was that at the behest of De La Court? Or?
It switched really not that long before it came.
Yeah, I know. I was like, I actually thought this was like a, you know, another novel that you were working on, then I realized, it's the same one.
I don't know when it was. It was really not that long before the book went to press that my editor and I started going back and forth with titles, and the publisher really was unhappy with my title, Ocean Beach, and they thought it was redundant. And they thought Ocean Beach.
That's the name of the place.
Well, I know. And then they pointed out there's also an Ocean Beach, I think, in San Diego or something. So it might be a bit misleading. So we went back and forth on a lot. I ultimately was very happy with the title that we chose, but it was a long road of coming to a title that we both agreed on. But ultimately, I think that, you know, it's good to have fog in the title because that's such an overarching image of the whole book is this fog. And
also you have the point where Abby declares that, you know, light is both the strength as well as the enemy of the photographer. And again, it goes back to this idea of what she sees versus what she does not see in her quest to, you know, whether Emma is there at Coit Tower or not.
Yeah.
Photography, I guess, it's odd in this book because it's there obviously in the beginning and then it disappears for a while and then it returns again. Maybe you could describe how the role of photography, was there a point where you said, I've got to kind of concentrate on the fact that she has this vocation and she has this interest? Or?
Generally, when I'm writing, whether it's a story or a longer work, I always have somewhere in the back of my mind, well, how is this person making his or her way in the world? And because I think it's kind of rare that someone can, you know, not have any vocation. I mean, you know, people do have trust funds, but in general, most people have to work for. And so for me, it's very natural that you have to think of something that the person does for a living. I specifically did not want her to be a writer, but I wanted.
Thank you.
I wanted her vocation to be something artistic. But it's not. I mean, she doesn't really take art photography. I mean, her job. She pays the bills by doing wedding photography and corporate openings and stuff. So, I wanted her to have the possibility of an art, but to be someone who was really supporting herself with a very sort of, you know, very clear cut. In a very clear-cut way. And to me, photography seemed like the natural, when I started thinking about what she would do with her daily life, photography seemed to fit, because she's a person who is really focused on what she, like you said, what she sees, what she doesn't see, and on, you know, how what is visually in front of her affects her perception of the world. Her perception of what was there, what was not there. So to me, it made sense that her world would be the world of photography. But I also wanted to play with this idea of the Holga images and the layering of the images and these strange exposures. And
and then, of course, the photo she takes at the beach, which is essentially like she's trying to find the clue and trying to find the answer. Mm-hmm. Well, when did surfing enter the equation? I have to ask.
You know, I have no idea. I really don't know.
Really? Do you feel guilty? Here I am. I've been 13 years in San Francisco, and I never tried surfing, you know? And so, you know, Was it that kind of like Ocean Beach Surfer Guild?
You know what? I think I watch them a lot, and I always am kind of in awe of them, that it looks really cool, but I know I would never do it. I mean, I might do it somewhere else, but I would not do it here. I don't have the balls, to put it bluntly. They're sharks. The waves are huge. It's cold, you know. But so how did that enter? I don't even know. You know, it's one of those arbitrary things that must have just sort of come up as I was writing. I mean, certainly I didn't have a moment early in the book where I thought, well, I'm going to get surfers in here somewhere. You know where it might have happened is when I was working on the book, I ended up doing a residency in Costa Rica, which, and I was there for a month at a writer's colony. And while I was there, I left the colony for a little while and stayed in this town that was a surfing town in Costa Rica, which obviously is extremely different from surfing in San Francisco. So I was watching them. So it's possible that while I was there, I really don't know. It'd be interesting to go back.
Maybe some sort of carryover figures, because you cite a surfing book in your foreword. So I'm wondering if what was it that kind of got you a little sort of obsessed with the subject or interested in the subject?
Well, I think it might have come from this character, Goofy, that whom Abby comes across when she's trying to get some information, because she meets. Oh God! She goes to a surf shop and she meets a woman who was there on Ocean Beach on the day that Emma drowned, and she sort of becomes friends with her on the. I say Emma drowned. That's not even what happened in the book. I'm being misleading.
Yeah,
that could have been an intentional red herring,
book.
But
yeah,
it wasn't.
An earlier draft,
that's the book I didn't write.
Actually, let's just throw them off and bend as many details. Abby is not a photographer. She is.
Yeah, she drills for oil wells or something.
Yeah. Halliburton. No. There you go.
So I think it might have arisen from this character, Goofy, and it arose probably in part from just my fascination with watching them, and also since the book begins at Ocean Beach and she keeps returning to Ocean Beach over and over again, that's something that she would inevitably see on days at Ocean Beach when you don't see anyone else because it's simply too miserable. You're likely to still see, you know, if the conditions are right, you're going to see some people out there in their wetsuits. So I think it's just such a permanent part of the landscape there that it probably couldn't escape my attention. But I like the idea of surfing as something that you really can't control. You have to have patience. You have to wait. Something has to sort of come to you, and then you have to take it at exactly the right moment. And Abby observes at one point that there is such you know, that a wave begins far, far out in the ocean, the swell begins, and by the time it gets to the point where it becomes a wave that you can actually surf, it is so unlikely that the surfer and the wave would meet at exactly that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That, you know, it's almost impossible that the right thing could ever happen. So I think she is thinking about that too, that, you know, the coincidence seems almost impossible.
Well, it's interesting too that you have, you know, Abby actually does not try surfing. It's just surfing is a part of this kind of tertiary nature of the plot, which is very interesting to me because you also mentioned this residency in Costa Rica as well as, you know, the ocean beach. I guess, it seems to me that all of your fiction writing, and in this one in particular, you need to be grounded in some kind of tangible, personal, rooted experience. Mm. Where do you kind of, I guess, go off the track and invent, and where do you kind of keep this? I mean, it seems very, very close to who you are as a person.
Where it was close for me is the idea of this woman who who's just utterly determined to do what she's going to do, even if it seems kind of ridiculous, or even if there's not going to be, even if she has to do things that seem kind of illogical. I mean, her determination is there. I mean, I think that probably is fairly close to my experience, but I mean, most of the plot elements are very fictive. I mean, when I wrote the book, I didn't have a child, so the missing child thing, that was very fictive. I went to Costa Rica, but the experience I had in Costa Rica is very different from hers. I mean, Abby goes into all these wildly dangerous places where she really shouldn't be, and she goes at strange times of the day and night, both in San Francisco and in Costa Rica, you know, and I would never do, you know, maybe that is, you know, who knows? I mean, who knows what, you know, writers do when we write, you know, maybe that's me, you know, experiencing in fiction the things that I actually wouldn't do. I mean, she's very much a risk taker.
Yeah.
I was actually talking to my brother-in-law, who's a biologist and who studies risk taking behavior. I was talking to him, not about the book, just about risk-taking. And as I'm talking to you, I'm realizing that that's exactly what she is. Yeah. She's a risk-taker. I'm not.
I guess, though, maybe I should rephrase the question and just ask you, how much of personal experience do you have to experience in order to actually have your characters experience something? I mean, what kind of, you know, maybe I don't want to use a percentage kind of value, but I mean, it seems to me that, like, for example, the surfing thing, you know, you didn't, obviously the plot may not have required it, but I guess though, going to Costa Rica or going to specific places, how much of that, you know, do you need to personally experience in order to write about it?
Well, I think I have to have an experience of a place to write about it. That's really key. I don't write about a place I haven't been to. So my very first book was mostly in Alabama, but then it was also Iceland and, you know, I don't know, Iceland, Atlanta, New York, just places that were very much a part of my experience 8 years ago when I was writing that book. And then my first novel was set in China and Alabama, very much a part of my experience. I had just spent some time in China working. So the place has to be, I have to be very familiar with and comfortable with a place to write about it. Actual events, I don't have to have any familiarity with the events, you know. I mean, I would say my life probably isn't that hard. I haven't experienced, you know, I've had to work really hard, but I haven't experienced these really tragic things, you know, knock on wood, that the characters have experienced. But I do, I think a lot of the emotional energy of a piece of writing, a novel or a short story, comes from personal experience. Maybe not the precise thing has happened, but, you know, I can understand, you know, the devastation of losing a relationship or the fear of what might happen to someone that you care about. I mean, I think, you know, the specific things haven't happened to me, but, you know, I can draw from a well of experience, you know, emotionally.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
No, I do. No, I got you. Well, I actually want to talk to you about the whole, you know, the notion of all these days gone. We're on day 42 and day 180. Yeah. It's almost, again, going to this whole year of fog thing, it's a sort of strange new time that Abby sort of invents throughout the thing. And sometimes the specific number is there, every single chapter. Sometimes it disappears. Mm-hmm. Was there a particular sort of, I guess, logic that you applied as to when she would refer to the days, you know?
When I'm reading a novel, I get annoyed if I can't figure out the time. If I can't figure out the if it's relevant and yeah. I can't figure out, you know, if I get really disoriented in time for no apparent reason, that gets frustrating. And to me, I thought with this book, it was important for the reader to know, you know, if she was 6 months into the experience or 3 months into the experience, or, you know, 1 month. I mean, because 1 month into it, her reactions would be a certain way. But if she's 8 months into it and she's still continuing the search at the fever pace that she was at the beginning, this says something about her. And this goes back to what you were talking about at the beginning, about her sort of unraveling and sort of going kind of nuts in her way. I mean, so to me, I mean, part of it was, I mean, I was keeping track, a timeline in my head and, you know, sort of jotting notes. But so I think putting the day was a way of keeping the reader abreast of just how far. And also it's just part of Abby's obsessiveness that, you know, she really, yeah, her life really does sort of start over at the day that this horrible thing happens. And she starts counting the days. Whether she wants to or not, she really is, okay, she's thinking, okay, Emma's been gone for 64 days. Now she's been gone for 93 days, and she obsesses over it. She can't get that out of her head. So I wanted that to be part of the reader's experience of the book, is, you know, understanding how obsessive Abby is, I guess.
I wanted to ask about the rather, probably the most unusual character in this book is the hypnotist with the gorilla and the purple, I believe. What was up with that?
Was that on her shirt or on her tie? I think that was on her. Oh, her scarf.
The scarf. Her purple scarf. With white right. monkeys. That's right. Yeah. I wanted to ask you about, like, you know, sort of eccentric, that eccentric character. Did you just why did this hypnotist appear? I mean, it's very much a kind of you know a crackpot to some degree, but at the same time, you know, the crackpot is sort of it's you pound the point home with this really bizarre, eccentric, sartorial choice.
As many people do, I have kind of a block against hypnotherapy or anything like that. And Abby has that block when her friend Nell, who's a librarian at the Mechanics Institute Library, tells her, well, you should go to this hypnotherapist because she can actually help you. And she tells her, you know, she's actually a very well-known, you know, well-known scientist, and she does this hypnotherapy as a reason. Anyway, and so Abby doesn't want to go, and but she's like, okay, well, I suppose I'll do anything. So she kind of is a bizarre, bizarre
person. Dr. Shannon, too.
Dr. Shannon.
Which, I mean, is that the surname or is that the real name? That's the question.
So Abby just finds the experience odd. And I felt like, okay, what would it be like if someone like Abby is sitting there in front of a hypnotherapist? She would be noticing the strange things about her and sort of unsettled by it. But the reason I had a hypnotherapist in there was that some of the research I did was just about how these searches go about. And I discovered, I can't remember now which case it was, maybe it was Perry Class or something very, very high profile, where a murderer was found specifically through through hypnosis, something like 6 months after the event happened. Some guy came forward and said, oh, I think I might have seen something, and they put him under hypnosis, and he, through the hypnosis, he was able to create a forensic artist do a sketch exactly of the person they were looking for, and, you know, so while it seems sort of just bizarre and crazy, there actually is some record of hypnotherapy working in cases like this, so I think that's why I had her in there. Yeah. And yeah, she's kind of.
But it does sound like a really melodramatic noir there.
Yeah.
Yeah. The interesting thing about Abby also is that she is trying to sort of deconstruct things, like, for example, the word origin of photography. Mm. And it's also referring to all these, like, little, you know, cultural minutiae in an effort to kind of, I guess, uncover things. Was this, you know, how much of this came about from your research? How much of this came about from, I guess, the Abby perspective of just like, I must understand everything. I must deconstruct.
Well, I think a lot of it was that as I was researching things I became interested in, like Holga. I became interested in, well, where does that word come from? And I can't say it properly. As someone where I did a reading pronounced it for me properly, Hoguang, but it means bright light. And so I would come across these little things, and they seem to really fit into themes of the book, so I would include them. So I think part of it certainly is Abby's obsessive deconstructing of everything around her, but part of it is just for me as I was researching memory or researching photography, but primarily memory, I was interested in these little details. Now, or, you know, I was interested in these little details about the early research of memory and early beliefs about memory and this massive theater that was built that people could walk through and sort of pick up objects, and they were supposed to be able to remember anything with precision and erudition if they could master this very physical memory theater. I mean, to me, that's, I was kind of putting things in the book that fascinated me when I discovered them.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, in terms of, though, tying it into sort of her quest, it's like these, in some cases, they're like these little sort of, I guess, you know, mini chapters to some degree, in the sense that there's this interesting sort of digression. I'm like, I was reading this going, how much of this actually ties into, I mean, these are actually interesting because they were sort of clues as to like, well, this is not exactly about Emma's disappearance, but it's actually more about her own kind of, I guess, identity crisis. I mean, when did these start being juxtaposed in the book? I mean,
I think that was probably pretty early on in the book. And I think it's probably just part of my process normally when I write is taking apart the smaller pieces and trying to figure out how they fit together and trying to fit chapters together like a puzzle. But it was important to me. I didn't want the book to be just, I didn't want it to be a traditional mystery. I didn't want it to be, you know, just a book that was about a kid who's missing and how the woman finds her. I wanted the subtext to go, you know, a lot deeper than that. So I think, so probably part of the motivation behind those very small chapters that have pieces about memory or about photography or other things are a way of sort of taking the reader away from the plot of the search momentarily to something else. And then we'll go, okay, and then we're going to go back to the plot in the next chapter. But, you know, so I was kind of trying to achieve a little bit of a back and forth between, okay, this is the story of the search, and then here is sort of the deeper layer of what the search means to Abby.
I wanted to actually ask you about I saw that there was an audiobook, actually, of this. Yeah. Were you involved with that? Or?
Absolutely not. That's, well, you know,
I was curious. I mean, that's just pretty unusual, yeah.
Well, they do, you know, contracts are very complicated things, but your publisher, you have control of some subsidiary rights. Your publisher has control of some of them. So I guess my publisher had control of the subsidiary rights for audio. And so I just got a call from my agent one day that they had sold the audio, which is, you know, I'm totally happy. But I don't listen to audiobooks, so it is kind of strange. So I had nothing to do with any of it, except I did get an email really not long before the book came out from the woman who was going to, it was just an email from someone I didn't know saying, oh, I'm going to be reading I'm going to start recording your book in, you know, a week. And so I wanted to ask you questions. Her name was Carrington McDuffie, and she's in LA. And this is what she does for a living. She does audiobooks, but she had questions, you know. She said, well, Abby's from Alabama. Does she have a Southern accent? And it's something that, you know, I had never even thought of. You know, it never occurred to me. I'm like, well, no, actually, she wouldn't have a Southern accent because I didn't. But anyway, no, I didn't have anything to do with it. And then I saw it online somewhere, the packaging for the audio. I think the audio came out the same time the book did, but I haven't. I've heard a clip of the audio, but I don't have it. Although
they didn't even send you the audio. I
imagine I'll get it. I mean, usually you get these things, you know, like you'll get. I got the Dutch copies of the book, and then I'll get. You get whatever they make, but you get it a little while down,
just
a little ways down the line.
To send Michelle the audio book.
But I did send it to my sister. I sent it to, you know, I bought it online and had it shipped to my sister because she had said she didn't want to read the book because she has a 6-year-old daughter. Her daughter's not 6 now, but her daughter's older now, but earlier when I was writing the book. Anyway, so I sent her the audio tape and, you know, told her, well, don't read it, just listen to it in the car. Maybe it won't be the same. Maybe it won't really disturb you the same. But I never heard back from her. So I don't know.
Wait a minute here. So she will be not disturbed by the audio, but she will be disturbed by the text?
Well, no. Well, to me, I think actually reading a book is a more intimate experience probably than hearing it, because I think probably people who listen to audiobooks are doing it while they're driving.
Yeah.
But while when you're reading a book, you're not doing anything else except possibly, you know, having bonbons and drinking coffee. Yeah. It's not like you're, or maybe you're doing the Stairmaster, but you're not, you know, involved in trying to navigate traffic or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think? Do you ever listen to audiobooks?
Sometimes. Very rarely, though, because I just really prefer the text.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, the problem with audiobooks is that I really like dramatic presentations, but, you know, it's like some of these audiobooks are really flat like this.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I'm with you. I mean, you know, intimacy from the page, but anyway.
Yeah, I would assume the experience of hearing it and reading it is it's an entirely different book in those two cases, so I wouldn't know.
Unless you actually were to, like, write the book specifically. This is the problem. A lot of audiobooks are not written.
Mm.
They're not written to be spoken aloud. Like,
yeah.
I mean, when I heard that David Foster Wallace was doing a reading of his own material, I'm thinking to myself, there is no way that you can read his work aloud and make it sound dynamic as it does on the page. And there's some stuff like that. And then there's, even when you do write, you should write to be spoken, but there's sometimes it just doesn't have that particular quality. Anyway.
Yeah.
Well, Michelle, it was a pleasure chatting with you.
Well, it has been lovely, Ed. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
And good luck to you in your big move.
Don't tell me that you get sick of living when the sun